Dan Levitard, if we're really being honest about it, it's just a giant piece of shit.
To the Big Suey.
Bald Eagles.
A podcast exclusive that none of our bosses asked for.
More sports.
More work. Less pay.
I haven't stopped talking in a month. I mean, I don't know what to tell you.
Just when you thought the show couldn't be more diluted. Bam.
Last time I listened to this show.
I haven't listened for years.
Now here's the marching band to nowhere.
Am I missing something? What am I missing?
The end of the story.
Fat face.
Chris Falica.
It's Falica. He made him a penis.
And the habitual liar.
I didn't ask for any of this.
You asked for all of it.
The Big Suey.
I'm Chris Cody, BSPN.
So some of you astute listeners of what we do around here might have felt this man's imprint on some of the things hiding in the shadows here. On what we've been doing with Big Suey, local hour. Like, I can't tell you how much I respect this dude as a creative force, because he's, you know, the father of like a my generation of comedy, right? Whether it's Saturday Night Live being at its heyday and writing for that show, or making the movies that I love so much that I quote lines from, whether it's, you know, Step Brothers or Anchorman, and then graduating from that, from Talladega Nights, from Sacha Baron Cohen, a genius in his own right, to now doing the heavy stuff, the heavy lifting in Hollywood, where he's doing the political movies, where he uses his power to do a movie with Billy Corbin, the Cocaine Cowboys director, about politics and Miami, because he's a gatekeeper at HBO, where he creates things like Succession, or is an executive producer on them. And, you know, a show like Netflix, Dead to Me, is just one of his side projects. Anyway, all of that is an awkward introduction to tell you how much I respect Adam McKay, who now is at the height of Hollywood with a release here just recently saying that he is making a movie about, I think it's about climate change. I'll talk to him about that in a second, but with the height of Hollywood, with, you know, you're talking about Meryl Streep and DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence. And so he's doing an important movie at an important time, trying to make it during a pandemic. And he joins us now, all of which is long-winded introduction to explain to the audience that I want to talk to him about his creativity and the projects that he's done. Funny or Die is another side project. Just like this is, he's got a ton of them. So anyways, Adam, thank you. If I had told you though, when, you know, you were doing, let's just make it Anchorman. Hey, in 15 years, it's going to be Streep, DiCaprio, and you're going to be the hotshot Hollywood director who gets to tell a climate change movie. Did you think that that's where it would end up?
No, definitely not. You know, I mean, you just do what's in front of you, you know, like, so we were so giddy to do Anchorman. We couldn't believe that we were out like in a, you know, parking lot with like expensive camera equipment and professionals around us. That was such a giddy experience. Farrell and I just laughing the whole time. So, no, I was happy to have a functioning working camera with a good DP behind it. That was like my dream achieved.
Okay, so what you're doing now is basically, because it's important, right? You've got a movie coming out on HBO because you took care of some local filmmakers here in Miami who are also very good, and you got something made here about Miami in October that you loved, right? Yours is a discerning palate. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that as well. What can we tell the audience about what your what that project, why that project is something that it was meaningful for you to do?
Well, honestly, I got to give you a fair amount of credit, because now I've gotten to know you pretty well through the years, and you're friends with Billy Corbin and Alfred Spellman, who terrific filmmakers who have done some of my favorite documentaries, Cocaine Cowboys, Screwball. I think one of the best 30 for 30s is The U, and a bunch of other great projects as well. So I was already huge fans of these guys. You know, I had had some brushes with them through the years, like, you know, just saying how much I appreciated Screwball and them coming back and saying, oh, thank you. But you were the one who told me they're working on a movie that's right up your alley called 537. And it's the 20th anniversary of the recount in Florida when the Supreme Court basically decided the election for George W. Bush over Al Gore. That was one of those kind of fork in the road moments in American history where we could have gone down one direction or the other. And because of intervention from Republican Party operatives, and nothing I'm saying, by the way, Republicans would agree with this, too, who know about what happened. This is what happened. They did an incredible job of getting down there with their operatives and swinging, making sure certain votes weren't counted and making sure through the Supreme Court that George W. Bush won that election, which changed the course of American history. So they did a documentary. And what I love about Billy and Alfred is whatever they do, it's got a buoyancy to it. It's fun. It's got a lightness while at the same time talking about really important stuff. And that's kind of what I try and do with the stuff I make as well. So it really was like a peanut butter chocolate kind of moment where when I started working with them and giving notes and going back and forth, I was like, oh, this fits like a glove. And best of all, the movie's terrific. And HBO bought it and given it a nice big fat premiere on October 21st. This is the definition of a movie you should watch with your kids, even if your kids are as old as 40 years old. I mean, this is a major moment in American history. And it's fun, and there's stuff in it I didn't even know about, even though I lived through it. So credit to you, man. You definitely hooked us up on this.
Well, the documentary, I don't know what you love the most about it, okay? But because it is the rare combination of funny and infuriating. But to me, the idea that these guys could make a movie that would absolutely explain what's happening in America right now today, as it feels like America's burning, without ever mentioning what's going on today, or just in a very glancing fashion. Like, it's not that overt that we've already lived what we're living now. We lived it in 2000.
It's remarkable. And you're 100% right. And what you realize is these, you know, the forces that have been kind of dismantling American government and society and all of our institutions, you know, they've been in play for a long time. You know, these things have been around. A lot of people can trace that some people call it the Reagan Revolution to the mid 70s when these forces started coming together with money and the religious right and the corporate right and all these things. So really what you see is all these episodes are almost like a Russian doll where it's the small one within the bigger, and they're all kind of mirrors of each other. So you're 100% right. You take that, this recount story, and it lays like a perfect template over what's happening now. It's the same forces, but in this case, it happened in one of America's most unique constrained towns, which you know very well, Miami, Florida, and Florida. So it's Billy and Alfred just have a great eye for what's happening in Florida, great sense, kind of like Carl Hyacin, kind of like yourself, a great sense of what Florida's about. And that was the part I loved about the movie. There was such a lens of local politics. You know, all politics is local. And yet it was local politics being magnified into the entire country. It's really so enjoyable, informative, funny, the characters. And then you're right, like just a baseline of holy crap, this whole last 20 years could have been completely different if that goes another way.
Well, it's funny because in getting to know each other in recent years, I've gotten a sense that you really know your politics, you really know your history, but that you had a bit of a blind spot, I gathered, about what exactly Cuban politics is. Because what happened with the Ilian Gonzalez story, I found, is that all throughout the country, it felt lonely, that story, as a Cuban American, as I lived it in 2000, because nobody understood what Cubans were saying because of how much we valued freedom. That kid's mother died trying to get him to freedom, and it felt very lonely trying to tell America that because America wasn't hearing it.
Yeah, and I had no idea because I was on Saturday Night Live when that all happened. In fact, I think I wrote one of the sketches they show a little, or co-wrote one of the sketches they excerpt in the movie. And I just didn't know about the, what would you call it? The powder keg and the political power of the Cuban American, population down in Southern Florida. You know, my knowledge of it was pretty much, you know, I knew about the rise of Fidel Castro. I knew, you know, I'd watched Godfather 2, so I knew it from that a little bit. I lived in Florida when I was a kid for like a year, but I was little, so I didn't really encounter it. And I just didn't understand those dynamics that were at play. And now you're seeing it again this year. I mean, I just saw a story that Billy Corbin posted, actually, about how Trump was trying to do business in Cuba and was registering LLCs down in Cuba and setting up to do real estate deals with the Cuban government. And I read it and I had a whole different layered, nuanced response to it. Like, God, what does the Cuban American population think in Florida at this? Like, do they care? Are they just down for Trump no matter what? And so, yeah, that's my favorite part of the documentary. It's just a whole world that I wasn't as familiar with.
It's interesting because the movie you're presently working on, and I don't know what we're allowed to tell people about DiCaprio and Meryl Streep, but one of the things that you're doing on a grander scale, it sounds like, is you're making the biggest Hollywood movie with the stars, and you want it to have a climate message. You want a climate change message. You are no longer just making the frivolous stuff that makes you laugh. You're now trying to make work that matters during an important time, which is what art is supposed to do. So are you just trying to laugh here with the movie you're making now, or are you trying to sort of give us a message about how, you know, your beloved California is burning with 125-mile-an-hour tornado fires?
I'm sorry, I have to laugh because every time I hear someone casually talk about fire tornadoes, it's something we would have written in a sketch at SNL in 1990. We would have made up the idea of a fire tornado, and now they're just part of the weather forecast in Florida. Yeah, the idea of this one was, this is a comedy, it's called Don't Look Up, and you're allowed to talk about it. We announced the cast yesterday, so it's DiCaprio, Jen Lawrence, and this actor Rob Morgan are the three kind of main scientists of the movie. And then Meryl Streep plays the president. Jonah Hill plays her son. Cate Blanchett's in it as a sort of morning political talk show host. And we've got Himesh Patel is Lawrence's boyfriend, great actor. Kid Cudi's in it. Ariana Grande is going to sing this incredible song for it. And so, yeah, we got an incredible cast. It's a comedy. It's some scientists discover, these kind of mid-level kind of schlubby scientists discover that, a 10-kilometer wide interstellar comet is going to hit Earth. And they have to go on a media tour to warn everyone. And basically, it was written initially as a pretty thinly veiled analogy for climate change. But now what's happened, because I wrote it before the pandemic, it's really now just about the way we communicate and how crazy everything is. And one of the scientists gets turned into a celebrity. The other ends up becoming like hated and, you know, and their worlds are just ripped apart. The science is twisted and, you know, confused. And it's a lot of stuff you would think would happen, but hopefully we do it in a unique and ultimately funny way. I mean, it's definitely a comedy. So it's going to be good to be able to laugh a little bit as we deal with fire tornadoes and and micro fire climates. That's another one I've been hearing about lately. And you know, parts of the Gulf Coast are hit with four consecutive hurricanes. I mean, it's just jaw dropping, the scale of it. Yet we still chug along talking about how Le'Veon Bell got released, which, by the way, don't get me wrong, I'm interested in it. I want to see where he goes. It's just funny, like, day in, day out, to be like, I just talked with a friend of mine. I wonder if the Steelers would take him back. And then the next news story is fire tornado hits hospital or something. It's crazy.
You don't want to hear about Tua's footwork? You don't want to? That's not something you want to hear about? This is the time you don't want to talk about Tua's footwork? You always want to talk about Tua's footwork.
I'll just ask one question. How are his hips? Is he flipping those hips when he's turning field? When he's breaking out of the pocket, is he flipping those hips fast?
Are you right now filming in Boston? Are you in the middle? You're saying all of this in the middle of a pandemic. I think you were supposed to be filming this movie a year ago. I don't know if you would have had DiCaprio and Meryl Streep if you had filmed it a year ago. But you're going to be telling the story of our times through this comedy, aren't you? Like, the pandemic is literally affecting you in filming.
Yeah. We're in Boston. We're in pre-production. We have the craziest safety protocols. I mean, borderline NBA level safety protocols. I love, by the way, that the NBA is now the medical gold standard. It's not the federal government. It's not the CDC. It's the NBA has now become the United States gold standard for epidemiological reactions and mitigation.
Sports and politics always colliding, yeah, as you know, McKay, as you know.
It's and so we're doing that here in Boston, and we're in pre-production, and so far so good. I mean, we test every week, we do spot tests, and we've had no positive returns, and the actors are coming in, and we have a whole crazy protocol to shoot. We're going to have kind of similar cast to what we had before the pandemic. Everyone was circling it and discussing it, but I think what happened is it just lit a fire under everyone, because everyone was emailing, you know, saying and jumping on the phone with me saying, I can't believe you wrote this before the pandemic, because half the stuff that it has happened. I mean, it's been really freaky. Although I always say that doesn't mean my writing is so prescient. It just means the total beep storm that we're in right now is so predictable that it's like saying, like, oh, when that car crashes, the window is going to break. I mean, that's the level of me being Nostradamus on this. It's all fairly obvious what's going to be happening. So, yeah, we're going to give it a go, man. And you know, the safety is so strong that everyone feels good about it. And if by chance we can't pull it off, then, you know, we go home and hopefully resume when there's a vaccine.
Adam, you are so good on the subjects of climate change and politics. Are you honored? Do you sort of take an amount of ego pride in the fact that DiCaprio and Meryl Streep, both very discerning artists, not just movie stars, but people who make choices that other people go to their movies because of those choices those people make, not just because they're good actors. Did they choose your movie because it is a comedy for our times? I don't think of those two as comedic actors.
I mean, the funny thing is they're both hilarious. You know, like Wolf of Wall Street is a comedy, in my opinion, and DiCaprio killed Bean. And that was one of the reasons when his name came up, I was like, oh, he could do this. Streep's been crazy funny in a bunch of stuff. You know, it's funny when you get to these actors when they're this good. They're funny. Like, one of the funniest actors I've ever worked with is Ryan Gosling. He's crazy funny. Christian Bale's really funny. Amy Adams has done comedy. So these really good actors just tend to be funny as well. So, yeah, I think definitely, I think we're all desperate for some way to process what's going on. You know, I mean, it is kind of what we do. And, you know, we make movies. So, you know, when you're living through something like this, the idea that you can do a movie that's like kind of processing it and dealing with it. And then on top of it, we get to laugh, which is definitely one of the best reactions you can have to what's going on, as grim as everything it is, as everything is. It was very exciting. It's, by the way, I don't mean to downplay it. It's always exciting when you write a script, and I'll never forget it with The Big Short, and you send it to these actors who you admire so much. And then you hear back, like, Ryan Gosling wants to do The Big Short. Meryl Streep loves it. She's in. Like, that is one of the most thrilling things, because, you know, I grew up watching these people. I mean, Meryl Streep, I think there's even not much of an argument, probably the greatest film actor in history. So, and by the way, the loveliest, warmest, most generous person. I know people say that about everyone, but she actually is. So when she said yes, I mean, there's no doubt. I was giddy like a 12-year-old for like 4 hours, you know?
Stugatz says she's a fraud. She's a fraud. Stugatz has pounded her as a fraud. Overrated is one of Stugatz's favorite.
It's LeBron
takes.
Argument. You can get to the final so many times, but how many times have you lost?
Yeah, you're a cliche, McKay. Saying all the throwing all the roses at our beloved Meryl, the overrated Meryl Streep. Mike, you've got to be surprised that McKay is saying that Christian Bale is really funny. I mean, is American Psycho a comedy?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite comedies of all time.
Yes. And he's funny in The Big Short. Like, there's some moments in The Big Short where he's hilarious when they confront him about, like, why are you making this crazy investment? That's all of our money. And there's really, he got huge laughs in that part. And he's a goofball. He's like, the craziest thing was shooting Vice, because he's in this, like, world-class makeup. You know, the guy literally, the team that literally won an Academy Award for it. And he looks exactly like Dick Cheney. And he keeps doing the voice, but you can still talk to him as Christian Bale. So I was like hanging out on the set with like funny, cool Dick Cheney.
I thought he was a thespian. You can be both things when you're saying, as a director, you're saying that to be good at acting, you almost have to be funny unless you're one of these self-serious guys like Mike Shannon.
Mike Shannon's funny. No, Mike Shannon is funny. I'm telling you. I've never met a great actor. Brad Pitt is hilarious. Like, have you ever seen Brad Pitt in Snatch? He is so funny.
I've got him right here, actually. Hold on a second. I've got him right here.
His impression is so terrible.
He's here. I've got him right here. I've got Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt and Snatch is right here.
This is like the lame version of parading Blake Griffin around.
Come on.
Donald Sterling. Okay. It's like Gervon, Perry, Winkle, Blue, Fetch of Heart. It's terrible. Don't do that anymore.
No. I'm saying, like, all right, here, like, when we were at SNL, sometimes we would have serious actors on, and everyone would go, are they funny? And if it was a really good actor, I'd go, yeah, they're, even if they're not funny, they're going to get it to the degree that you know they're going to be good. And sure enough, like, Julianne Moore hosted and was awesome. Like, every sketch she was in, she was incredible just because she's a great actor. Like, I mean, the only guy, I've never met him, but, like, is Daniel Day-Lewis funny? That would be the one. But he, I don't know. I've never asked anyone. That's the one.
You never asked anyone? You've got access to all these people. How can you not ask the question of whether or not Daniel Day-Lewis is funny? He's the guy, didn't My Left Foot, right? He became a character actor, and he actually lived his life for how long with only his left foot?
Yeah. I mean, and he actually did it for months and months and months. And he is a guy who stays in character. Like, when you talk to him, I do know this. When he's off camera, he stays in character, and you have to refer to him as the character. Whereas Bale stays in character, but it's weird. You could still talk to him as Christian Bale.
Is Daniel Day-Lewis funny? You can't just ask him.
I'm going to now. I mean, when I talk to him again, I will definitely ask him. Is he funny? Does he crack jokes? Is he silly? Is he? Yeah. Now I will find out. I will bring you that information back. All right. I got a question for you. Is Adonis Haslam funny?
Udonis Haslam, I think I've told this story before. I've only seen Udonis Haslam laugh one time, and it's when I came back into the highly questionable studio, and I've covered him since high school, and he is leaning up against my father, and they're watching my father do rap video lyrics with the rappers themselves on television. And so Udonis Haslam might be funny, but I had never seen it before my father brought it out of him.
I think our goal, our joint venture between our company and you guys has to be get Udonis Haslam on the Larry David Show.
Okay.
I think that has to be like our sole mission. And I know some of the writers on it, and Larry David's around town, and we got to get him to do a scene on that show.
Well, didn't I think Roy Hibbert, Mike Schur was all happy because Roy Hibbert was in an episode of Parks and Rec, just the most random thing you've ever seen in your life. All of a sudden, didn't Roy Hibbert becoming a recurring character in Parks?
Detlef Schrempf did.
Oh, we've got to start planting athletes.
I don't know if you're kidding.
We've got to. No, he's not kidding.
He's not kidding,
but we've got to start planting. Hold on a second.
No, when Tommy had the warehouse for his company, he just paid obscene amounts of money just to have Detlef Schrempf playing pickup ball in the offices.
Sean Kemp was on Wings for 3 seasons.
Wait a minute.
That's not true.
That can't be true. Wait a minute. McKay, this is what you've got to do for the Big Suey audience and for the Local Hour audience and for all the podcasters. You have to help us figure out a way to randomly get, maybe, can we get Udonis Haslam in your movie? In this movie, can I get Udonis Haslam, not in Curb Your Enthusiasm,
you know,
making
what?
An appearance next to Meryl Streep? Next to Meryl Streep.
All right, wait, can I tell you my Sean Kemp story?
Yes, of course.
So we try and get Anchorman made, Farrell and I. No one will make it. Every financier, every studio, I've told this story before. Everyone says no. It was like 22 no's. It was like just like you're a boxer and you broke your right hand and you can't throw it anymore and a guy's just hitting you in the face with 22 straight punches. So it was an awful, awful week. So that's it. You go to the back of the line. We couldn't get our movie made. So the only movie that anyone would greenlight for Farrell is a movie where he's a grown man who plays an elf. And we get Jon Favreau to direct it. And I come out to L.A. and I'm in a hotel room. And we're kind of sitting there like, what happened? Like, how did it all go so wrong that we're rewriting a script where you're a grown man playing an elf? And Farrell's just looking at me like, I don't know, man, but it's the only movie I got. Like, it's the only thing anyone will let me do. And we were like, all right, then we got to make it good. Like, let's just write our asses off. We'll do the best we can. And meanwhile, I'm in this hotel room, and I start see this very tall African-American guy walking up and down the stairs. And I love the NBA. So I'm like, holy crap, that's Sean Kemp. And we start putting it together, and we realize Sean Kemp has come into L.A. because his career is kind of winding down. I think the Cavaliers had cut him, and the Clippers were giving him a tryout, and the Lakers were giving him a look. So he was staying in this hotel in Santa Monica. And every morning I would walk up to go to the hotel room because I wasn't staying there. We were using it as a writing room. And I would see outside Sean Kemp's door, there would be like three empty plates from pizzas. And I was like, oh, Sean, no, no. And then I got to give it up to Jon Favreau. Very, very funny. Sometimes I would be standing by the open doorway on this balcony and right across from him was Sean Kemp and would walk out of his room and Favreau would yell, hey, Sean. And then Favreau would duck away. So it would just be me left standing in the doorway looking at Sean Kemp. After someone just screamed his name and I would have to wave at him awkwardly. But anyway,
I did that with Pat Gillick. Your story, wait a minute. Your story's so much cooler than mine. I did that with former Blue Jays general manager Pat Gillick. You did it with Sean Kemp and Favreau.
Yours isn't bad though. Don't in some ways the more obscure the name, the better. Anyway, the final thing is we finished the Elf script. Everyone was happy with it. My last day there, I saw Sean Kemp and I was like, hey man, this is weird, but we've been writing a script over here for the last 3 weeks that you've been here. Will you sign my script? So I have the first draft or maybe the third draft of Elf, because there was another draft before, of Elf, and it's autographed by Sean Kemp. It's one of my favorite objects that I own.
Elf. Okay, we've got to get you out of here because you're an important Hollywood person and you've got a very hard out here. But I wanted to talk to you. Like, you've got a side projects, things like you're the executive producer with Farrell on things like Dead to Me and Succession. Like, you've become a real tastemaker when it comes to like discerning television making, even as your side projects. Like, how does all of that come to be? You talk. And they will take you away, drag you, famous Hollywood director guy. But just explain to me, like, how it is that you have your fingerprints all over so many cool things.
Well, that was those shows came out of, I had a company with Farrell for 14 years, Gary Sanchez Productions. And basically, you know, you hire really good producers who work with you and find projects and bring them back. So in the case of Dead to Me, that's a great producer who still works with Farrell, Jessica Elbaum, found that show, and it was great. You know, you read the first script, you hear the pitch, you know, you give a couple notes on the first edit, and otherwise that's really talented people doing a good job. So yeah, in that case, you're kind of the gatekeeper in the sense of you try not to let anything through that's not good, and all credit to Jessica Elbaum, she found that show. In the case of Succession, that's a writer, Jesse Armstrong, we've worked with before. Kevin Messick heard that he was working on this pilot, got me an early copy, and I was like, I will direct this pilot. We'll be producers on it. We will back this 100%. So, yeah, it's basically the trick is the trick for everything you do, hire good people. And, you know, we have that Lakers show was picked up for series for HBO. It's still untitled. It was originally called Showtime, but we're messing with the title. So that was one where we had read the Jeff Perlman book. We loved it. And we're just like, we got to do this. Max Borenstein, really talented writer, wrote it. I directed the pilot. We're now producers on it. We have another show, Motherland, same thing. Elliot Lawrence, great writer, read his treatment for it, loved it. So yeah, a lot of it's like people start to trust you, like HBO we have a deal with, so they trust us that we're not going to do lousy stuff, hopefully, knock on wood. And they then, when you get the project, you hope it's good enough that they want to lay some money down to make it. But the fun of it is you get to work with all these different really talented people like Elliot Lawrence, like, you know, in the case of Hustlers, a movie we produced, Laureen Scafari, a crazy talented writer, director, like such a joy to get to work with her. And so you just get to meet all these cool people and blend with different styles. And that's my favorite thing about it with producing is you can only do so much when you write and direct. But you get to be involved with like Billy Corbin and Alfred Spellman with 537. And these are people I've admired forever. And So yeah, it's really fun. So we have a new company now, Hyper Object Industries. We've been around for about a year and a half, going on 2 years, and we're doing this Don't Look Up movie and the Lakers show, and we're, you know, Succession and a bunch of other things. And we just have great producers, Todd Shulman, Betsy Koch, Kevin Messick. And that's really the trick.
I wanted to ask you about that Showtime project. The Showtime project, it's Jerry Buss, and is it John C. Reilly, or what can be announced there?
Yeah, I think they announced that. I can't remember. Maybe I'm making a mistake, but screw it. You can say it. John C. Reilly plays Jerry Buss and is crazy good. Jason Clark plays Jerry West. Solomon Hughes plays Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. We have all these like great actors who are playing these real characters. Devon Nixon, who is Norm Nixon's son, plays Norm Nixon in the show and is just astoundingly good. It's an incredible cast. I mean, it was kind of a dream show for me because it's basketball, but then it's also dealing with issues of race, class, and, you know, racism and basketball and like, and what it means for American culture. So it's got a little weight to it, but at the same time, it's fun as hell. And I just love that show. I'm so excited for that to come out.
How about the journalism podcast project that you're doing with the Miami Herald reporter who, broke one of the seminal stories in journalism with everything that happened with Jeffrey Epstein?
Julie Brown, man, incredible what she did. I mean, that story was fading away. Horrific, horrific story of billionaires sex trafficking young teenagers, underage girls. And yeah, Julie Brown just wouldn't quit on it. So we're doing a podcast with her. It's called Broken, Seeking Justice, and we work with the victims to not let this case go away because, man, oh, man, do a lot of powerful people want it to go away. And we're doing that with Three Uncanny Four Productions. Tara Palmieri is the host of the show, Adam Davidson from Three Uncanny Four. We have another podcast that I'm doing coming out. I love the podcasting. It's called Death at the Wing that I'm actually hosting and I've been working on. That'll probably be out in January. And it's about just the rash of young, talented basketball players in the 80s and in the 90s who died tragically or through drugs, had their careers derail and their lives derail. It's an incredible amount of really young, up-and-coming stars that we lost during that age, and you just don't see it anymore. And so we kind of go into it, like, why did this happen in this 15-year time period of the 80s into the 90s? Why did we lose all these players? So once again, that's kind of about basketball. It's about, like, political change. It's about class. It's about, you know, conceptions of wealth and excess. And I think that'll be a really cool show, too. I'm excited to get that out. But the one thing I got to say, Dan, you've been having this guy Shane Bacalotto on. It's like, no politics, just sports. I just want to tell you and his partner, Harry the Horse, be careful who you associate with, man. Those guys seem like creeps. And I don't know why you would have them on. I mean, I'm hearing like laws being broken when they talk to you. Like, I get it, the ratings are sky high, but I just feel like you're better than that, honestly, as a friend.
Okay, I really don't need sermonizing from you. Thank you. We All appreciate right. All your right. time. All, we, right. all we did was plug you this entire time, like every damn project you've got going on. It was like seven. You dropped so many names, so many producers. It was like a Oscars speech. Like it was
yeah,
just.
But you also took 10 minutes introducing
him.
Full Hollywood, dude. Full Hollywood.
I can't say that show. I can't say the Julie Brown show without saying the people that are doing. I don't know what to do because they'll hear it. They'll be excited that it's mentioned. And then it's just me going, yeah, I did that. That was all me. Like, you got to mention, like, dead to me. I can't talk about that and not say Jessica Alba.
All right, get out of here. Enough. I don't want to hear about any more producers.
I'm not going to get out of here. You're going to hear about it. You're going to hear that your view of Hollywood.
Stop interrupting me.
Golden tuxedos driving a sports car.
Stop interrupting me.
You're better than that.
I'm talking.
Can I?
Ten seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Your relationships, your skills, your customer base. How about businesses on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/network, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/network now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/network.